Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. October is in the air, and MLB's League Championship Series are set to begin. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll have the latest regarding the Diamonds' Final Four. Also, an NHL season preview, a look at the NBA's dwindling prospects for an unabbreviated campaign, and brave athletes put Cleveland back on the sports map by rowing on the once-notorious Cuyahoga River. Also coming up, the long-lasting appeal of long-distance motorcycling.
I was a rider in the early 80s, and I thought that I had put motorcycles behind me. Well, you know, you really can't do that when they're in your blood. They'll come and find you.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There was celebrating amongst the Milwaukee Brewers last night after they beat the Arizona Diamondbacks 3-2 to gain a spot in the National League Championship Series. Niger Morgan, who refers to himself as Tony Push, knocked in the winning run in the 10th inning. Later on in the evening, pitcher Chris Carpenter of the St. Louis Cardinals baffled the Philadelphia Phillies for 9 innings, beating them 1-0 and securing for St. Louis the second spot in the NLCS. ESPN's Tim Kirkchen was among the unsurprised when St. Louis knocked off the favored Phils.
Do not ever underestimate a Tony La Russa team. Do not ever look past a team that has Albert Pujols on it, not to mention Lance Berkman and now a suddenly kind of healthy Matt Holliday. So they have a very interesting club there, but I think they have fought so hard to get here, and their bullpen is not very good and kind of worn out. We'll see if they can make it through. My guess is they're not going to get to the World Series.
On Thursday night, the Detroit Tigers advanced to the American League Championship Series by outlasting the Yankees in Game 5 of the American League Division Series in New York, an achievement that Tigers manager Jim Leyland found gratifying.
The Yankees are so good that I'd be lying if I said it didn't give me a little extra satisfaction to be able to do it here in the fifth game, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, I mean that respectfully.
Did having to go the distance in that series against the Yankees wear out the Tigers? Michael Rosenberg, who's been covering the team for the Detroit Free Press, thinks we may begin to learn the answer to that question tonight when the Tigers send out their 24-game winner, Justin Verlander, to face the Texas Rangers.
The big thing to me is going to be in tonight's Game 1, are we going to see the dominant Verlander we saw this summer, or are we going to see someone who's just a shade shy of dominant? My sense of it is that he's got those playoff jitters and the ability to channel his adrenaline, he's figured that out, and that he's really going to have a great opening game, and that would be huge for the Tigers, obviously.
It has been a dandy couple of months to be a sports fan in Detroit. The Tigers are poised on the brink of the World Series, and the Lions seem to be casting off their reputation as the laughingstock of the National Football League. Rosenberg has been writing about the local teams for a dozen years, and he's never seen anything like it.
We've actually canceled winter in the state of Michigan this year. We're just going to have summer year-round. People are very excited. The Lions in particular, I mean, it's been 10 years of just being non-competitive, just being awful. And here they are 3 years removed from an 0-16 season. They're 4-0 with the Bears coming in for Monday Night Football, and this is about as good as I've ever seen all Detroit teams at one time since I've been here.
The Texas Rangers will be trying to put all the pressure to delight Detroit fans on the Lions by beating the Tigers. The Rangers are the only team that earned some breathing room before the League Championship Series could begin. According to Richard Durrett, who's been covering Texas for ESPNDallas.com, dispatching Tampa Bay with relative ease should work in the Rangers' favor.
I think it's got to help Texas. Not only did they get a little time off, but then they got to stay at home. The team wondered if they were going to have to get up Friday morning and get on a plane to go to New York, and they waited around late on Thursday night before finding out that, no, they'd be able to stay at home for yet another day. So I think that has to help. Batteries recharge. Anybody that's got some nicks and bruises, and that's everybody this time of year, gets a chance to get a little bit of a break.
That advantage notwithstanding, Durrett feels Texas and Detroit are evenly matched.
You're talking about two of the best offenses, two of the best pitching staffs in the American League, two of the more balanced teams in that league. I think most folks will tell you, me included, that they expect a long series, a 6 or 7 game series here. Rangers have the home field, which can be a very big deal in a close series like this, and they've also proven in their American League Division Series that they can win close games.
According to ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, we can anticipate a worthy semifinal on the American League side despite the absence of the usual suspects. Mr. The Yankees Are Still the Yankees himself predicts an excellent show.
No Yankees, no Red Sox in the League Championship Series. Trust me, Bill, no problem here. There's star power everywhere on these two teams.
The Tigers and Rangers will open their series in Texas tonight. Tomorrow, the NLCS will begin when the Brewers host the St. Louis Cardinals in Milwaukee. The WNBA determined their champion last night when Simone Augustus led the Minnesota Lynx to a 73-67 triumph over the Atlanta Dream, completing a 3-game sweep. The news in the NBA was not so cheerful. The league, which locked out the players months ago, has already canceled its preseason. Earlier this week, Commissioner David Stern announced that the regular season would be shortened if a deal was not in place by Monday, and last night multiple sources were reporting that there would be no Monday meeting between the players and the owners. Joining me now to discuss the negotiations, or lack of same, is Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Chris, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here.
For our listeners who have unaccountably not been following labor management negotiations in the NBA day to day, give us a brief summary of the key issues.
The most significant issue is the split of the basketball-related income. Now, to put it into context, in the last collective bargaining agreement, the players received 57% of all basketball-related income. This time around, the owner's opening offer was to cut that all the way down to 43%. They have since come up to a even 50-50 split, but the players have said that that's simply too low for them to go. If you want to look at it this way, each percentage point they come down essentially means giving $40 million back to the owners. And you play that out over a 6 or 7 year agreement, and you're talking about potentially more than $1 billion that they'll be handing back to the owners if you come all the way down to 50-50. So right now, we're at kind of a classic impasse. They last met on Tuesday. It did not appear to end very well. And as you said, David Stern said that on Monday, if we don't have an agreement, we're going to wipe out the first 2 weeks of the regular season. And from there, it's just going to only get worse.
For the sake of clarity, have the two sides been able to agree on what basketball-related income, a.k.a. BRI, actually is?
Well, no, they haven't, because the NBA has sort of redefined what BRI is, and in doing so, they've created $350 million worth of expenses that they're essentially shaving off the top before they make that 50-50 split. Now, the one wrinkle to all this, and the most relevant wrinkle, I think, is that the NBA is saying now, in their latest proposal slash offer slash whatever you want to call it, is that they will give them a 50-50 split of the BRI definition as it was previously constituted in the last collective bargaining agreement.
Chris, there have been reports that the NBA's star players are willing to take a harder line than the role players, who make up a majority of the union and typically make much less money. How does that affect the union's stance at the bargaining table?
Well, it factors in considerably, because there's a lot of internal strife, I think, at the NBA Players Association right now, because you said it. I've been reporting a lot of that as well with a lot of role players, guys that are the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th guys on teams' benches who generally make less than $3 million per year, saying, well, you know, to us, a 50-50 split sounds pretty fair. Now, on Wednesday, Billy Hunter and Derek Fisher released a letter to the players' rank and file, essentially outlining why they believed a 50-50 split was unfair. But I'll tell you this, there are a lot of players that simply don't buy it. And these are players that, even though they've made a considerable amount of money for most of us in their careers, they have not saved well. And they're not, I don't think they're prepared to go into a potential season where they would lose a chunk of games or lose an entire season altogether.
The NBA has fewer players than the other three major sports in the U.S., so the players' union is by far the smallest, about 400 members. Does that create a different dynamic among NBA players than, say, the members of the NFL Players Association?
I don't think so, because I think when you talk about the NFL and the NBA, it's kind of apples and oranges, because the NFL was making tons of money. Everybody knew they were making tons of money. It was the owner's goal in that league to make even more money. So they weren't necessarily making concessions, as big a concessions, I think, as the players in the NBA are being asked to make. Now, the NBA has done a fantastic job of winning the PR battle throughout this whole process. I mean, their statement that 22 out of 30 teams are losing money has essentially become a verifiable fact that is being run on radio stations and newspapers and magazines on the internet worldwide, when in reality it's something that the Players Association hotly disputes.
Do you have a sense of whether the league is right or the players are right?
The players acknowledge that they have to give something back. And I think that owners should accept some responsibility for the bad decisions that they have made. You know, a lot of owners out there, for lack of a better phrase, they want to make the next system idiot-proof. You know, they want to make sure that they can go out there and spend as much money as they want and give away as many bad contracts as they have to, and then have the collective bargaining agreement save them from themselves. You know, a guy like Rashard Lewis, who a few years ago was signed to a six-year or seven-year, I'm sorry, $118 million contract. You know, he didn't put a gun to the owner's head and say, sign me to that deal. What's he supposed to say when an owner comes to him and says, here's $118 million? He's not expected to say no. So I think the players are correct in the sense that they have to, you know, the owners have to be responsible for this.
Failure of management and labor to agree resulted in a 50-game schedule during the 1998-1999 season. If a deal isn't reached by Monday and the league eventually ends up playing another partial season, what kind of effects would you expect that to have on the NBA?
I think most significantly it will have an effect on attendance. I mean, we saw that in 1998 and 99 when the season actually started. The fans were insulted, and rightfully so, and were turned off by the greediness of what they consider a battle between billionaires and millionaires. The league is coming off arguably its most successful season in decades, and really since the Michael Jordan, the heyday of the Michael Jordan era. I mean, ratings were through the roof, attendance nationally was up a little bit. Everything is sort of spinning in a positive direction, and I think if the owners can just start to make a little bit more money, I think everything would work out.
Chris, I'm going to close with a two-part question. Will the NBA play a full 82-game season? And if a deal is reached so that that season can go forward, what's it going to look like?
I think no, the NBA will not play a full 82-game season. I do think the NBA will go ahead and cancel the first 2 weeks of the regular season. The two sides will come back to the table. They'll hammer out some kind of agreement, and I think that agreement will look a lot like the final offer the NBA put on the table right now, where you have a 50-50 split with the basketball-related income definition being what it was the last time around. Yeah, I'm sort of oversimplifying what this negotiations look like, but that's the biggest thing that these two sides have to agree on, and I think they will agree on it in mid-November, late November, on the NBA's terms.
Chris Mannix covers the NBA for Sports Illustrated. To get his updates on the lockout and negotiations, you can follow him on Twitter at ChrisMannixSI. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Fans of baseball or football have had their ashes scattered over or buried under the fields where their favorite teams have played. The ashes of people who've loved sailing have been cast upon the waters over which they once sailed. Now hunters, too, can carry their passion for a sporting activity of sorts beyond the veil. Two game wardens in Alabama are turning cremated ashes into ammunition, which can be fired at deer, birds, or pesky critters. Of Holy Smoke, the company he helped establish, Thad Holmes says, "It's about celebrating life. For those who are comfortable around guns, it's not weird at all."
Jump the gun. Happiness is a wonder, mama. Happiness is a wonder. Happiness is a wonder.
Happiness. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Cleveland's Cuyahoga River welcomes athletes with an inextinguishable passion for rowing. But first, there has been no talk this season of an NHL lockout. Not yet, anyway. In fact, it seems like the 2010-2011 campaign just ended a week or so ago. But the NHL season is, in fact, upon us, so it's time to talk with Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Helene, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks so much, and it really does feel like the season ended yesterday, doesn't it?
Oh, isn't it the truth? Hockey fans here in Boston, of course, have been celebrating pretty much nonstop since June 15th, which is when the Bruins won their first Stanley Cup title in nearly four decades. Would it be irresponsible of me to suggest that this team could be celebrating a championship next year as well, even though they lost on opening night when they raised the banner?
No, I think it's a very reasonable suggestion because the Bruins are largely the same team. I mean, the core is there. They've obviously been through pressure, so they know what it's like to win pressure. They won three game sevens along the way. But, you know, if it were that easy to win back-to-back championships, somebody would have done it since the Red Wings last did it in 97 and 98. I mean, I think the hockey playoffs are the most taxing in any sport. I mean, you're going at it for 2 months. You're crisscrossing the country in the finals. It takes a lot out of you. It really isn't easy to repeat, but I think the Bruins do have a decent chance.
The Vancouver Canucks and their fans must have had a tough summer. They won the first two games of the finals, lost Game 7 at home. Has the team made any significant changes since losing in the finals?
Well, they lost one of their key defensemen, actually, Christian Ehrhoff, as a free agent. But it was a difficult summer in Vancouver for a lot of reasons. I mean, there were a lot of examinations into what happened with the post-Cup riots and why they weren't prepared. And, you know, to be fair, there were some good stories coming out of that, and that a lot of people went downtown and volunteered to clean up. That was nice to see, you know. But it was a tough summer for the Canucks, and I'm curious to see how they react to that. I think psychologically it could really drain them, and I wouldn't be surprised if they have a little bit of a slow start.
Which teams helped themselves most in the offseason and which did least to improve themselves?
You know, I look at the Chicago Blackhawks and I really like some of the moves they made in terms of adding some toughness. I think they're better now. I think they're stronger. I think they're deeper. I like what they did. You know, you look at San Jose, and, you know, every year people pick San Jose to win the cup, and every year people sit there and go, why did I do that? I should have known better. But, you know, this year they shook things up a little bit. I like what they did. I think they mixed the chemistry a little bit, and at least maybe they'll go to the conference finals before they choke again.
The Pittsburgh Penguins have been without star player Sidney Crosby since January. Do we have any update on when he is expected back? And what do you think about the Penguins returning to championship form?
You know, with concussions, it's just so unpredictable. You know, there's been progress for Crosby. He went with them on their season-opening trip out to Western Canada and across the not yet frozen Canadian prairies, but he's not ready for contact. He's not ready to play. It's really impossible to put a date on it. You know, that said, I really like the Penguins this season. Evgeny Malkin missed an awful lot of last season with a knee problem, and he's come back from surgery, and from what I've seen and read, he's just looking terrific. So I really like that team. I think that team and the Capitals and your Boston Bruins will be battling it out towards the end.
Have you got a team that nobody likes much, a potential dark horse to kind of put us on to at this point?
That's a really good question. You know, some people are looking at the St. Louis Blues and saying that they can improve this season. They were struck with a lot of injuries last season. They didn't have the depth to cope with that. So some people are looking at the Blues. I wouldn't call the LA Kings a dark horse, but a lot of people are looking at them as a potential Western Conference finalist because they made some moves in the offseason, acquiring Mike Richards, signing Simone Gagné, that really have given them more depth than they've had in an awful long time.
The league has a new team, sort of. The Winnipeg Jets, nay Atlanta Thrashers, will bring hockey back to long-suffering Manitobans. Will the change of location help that underachieving franchise?
Well, you can look at it two ways. They're going to be playing before crazy, happy, packed houses every single game. So if you're looking for an emotional lift, they'll get that. But because the move happened so late, the NHL didn't realign, so the Winnipeg team is still in the Southeast Division. So you're going to have some very goofy road trips coming up here.
The NHL's new league disciplinarian, Brendan Shanahan, has not been shy about exercising his authority, even in the preseason, when he suspended a number of players for illegal hits. And some NHLers have voiced their approval. Will Shanahan be able to change the culture of the NHL?
I think he will, and I can't say enough how I applaud Shanahan for being open about his decisions. I mean, he does these videos. Every time he issues a decision, he posts a video on the NHL website, and it's just so amazing and so refreshing for him to stand there and say, this is why I did this. This is what this player's responsibility was. This is what this player could have done. And the other day, he also did a compilation of clean hits, and I suspect that was in reaction to critics who were starting to mumble about they were taking the physicality out of the game, and he was showing a compilation of hits that are legal. You can still hit people shoulder to shoulder. You can still check people, but you just can't go for the head. You'd think, gee, that's logical, but this is the NHL. So logic and the NHL are not often acquainted.
The National Hockey League, of course, has gone through its own labor management problems in the past. This time around, it's the NBA that's been locked out. Do you get a sense of kind of happiness among the hockey community about that?
You know, I don't think anybody's going to be dancing on the NBA's grave at this point, because September 15th, 2012, the NHL's labor agreement expires. And no league wants to see another league in a labor strife situation. It's just not good for the fans. It's just not good for any sport.
Yeah, plus the NHL can't exactly say, this has never happened to us.
That's right, yeah.
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the LA Times, and she joins us from time to time to talk pro hockey, even during years when the cup does not reside in its rightful place. Thank you, Helene.
Thank you. I want to ride that great Zamboni.
Next year, U.S. Rowing, the national governing body for competitive rowing, will debut a new Masters Head Race National Championship in, of all places, Cleveland, Ohio. Compared with Boston and Philadelphia, Cleveland's rowing scene is quite young, and its Cuyahoga River is best known for catching fire back in the 1960s. So why is it now a prime site for some of the nation's best rowing athletes? We sent reporter Karen Schaefer to the 2011 head of the Cuyahoga race to find out.
It's just after sunrise on a chilly fall morning, and heavy clouds obscure the skyline of downtown Cleveland. Despite the weather, a group of rowers is gathering outside a boathouse on the Cuyahoga River, getting ready for a day on the water.
Where do you row, they say. Yeah, we say in the Cuyahoga, in the and they say, what?
No, they say you row in the Cuyahoga, that river that burns.
We get that a lot.
Cleveland rowers now in their 50s and 60s, like Janet Clark, Tim Markovi, Sharon Romilly, and Mary Ryan, can remember the days when the industrial Cuyahoga River was so polluted with oil and debris it often caught fire. But these days the river's a lot cleaner. And for younger rowers, like 27-year-old Rachel Stanley, the Cuyahoga's infamous past is something for the history books. Stanley is one of more than 800 Clevelanders, age 14 to 81, who've fallen in love with rowing on the Cuyahoga.
We joke that we're actually dating rowing. That's one of our ongoing jokes. We see rowing 6 days a week. We're in a very committed relationship.
Stanley's crew is one of two teams competing later this month in Boston's prestigious Head of the Charles race. She acknowledges that rowing on the Cuyahoga poses challenges athletes in other cities don't face, like dodging Lake Erie freighters and barges heading upstream and breathing in the stench from the city's remaining steel mills. But Stanley's friend, 30-year-old Karen Trimble, says the challenges are worth it, especially when you consider the track record of Cleveland's professional sports teams.
You know, Cleveland is a sporty town. We just don't have much luck in winning in the end. So except for us, our teams usually come home with some medals every year.
Even so, most people in Cleveland have no idea that local rowers are winning regional and national competitions. The Cuyahoga had never seen racing shells until 1988, when just four rowers in used boats started racing. But over the years, interest in the sport has grown. Now, more than 1,000 high school, college, and adult rowers from Cleveland and other Midwest cities compete every September in the annual Head of the Cuyahoga race. Today, Rivergate Park is packed with racing shells, competitors, and spectators. Out on the river, rowing crews who finish their races jockey for position as they wait for their turn to come ashore. Clusters of beaming fans on the riverbank welcome their champions home. Peggy Bailey's 14-year-old son, Drew, and his 8-man freshman crew from St. Ignatius High School have just won their very first race.
Well, they practice every night for 2 hours and 45 minutes, and then Saturday mornings for a couple hours, so they put in a lot of time. It's an awesome workout, but you know what? He loves it.
The Cuyahoga race is sponsored by the Cleveland Rowing Foundation, which last year moved into new headquarters on a former industrial site on the Cuyahoga, now called Rivergate Park. The foundation spent $3 million for a new boathouse and nearly 7 acres of prime riverfront real estate. 2 of those acres will become a public park, and there are plans to add more boathouses, a picnic area, a concession stand, even a gym. Teresa Gang is the group's executive director. It was her idea to invite U.S. Rowing to bring the first-ever Masters Head Race National Championship to Cleveland.
I think it's going to be tremendous to have them come here and host in Cleveland. It puts our name on the map because everyone was shocked, like, we're going to Cleveland. And we have affordable accommodations, we have great restaurants, we have unique places to visit, and why not Cleveland?
U.S. Rowing Events Manager A.J. Dominic says, judging by this year's crowd, there should be ample space at Rivergate Park for the 3,000 or so national competitors and fans anticipated at next year's race. That's small potatoes compared to the 300,000 visitors Boston attracts each year. But Dominic says coming to a new city fits with his organization's mission to expand rowing's appeal. And he really likes the course for the Cleveland race.
All along, that's kind of been the thing that's kind of caught my attention the most, is coming down, seeing the skyline, being in the middle of the city. It's a very challenging course. I think there are 3 or 4 major turns and twists in the river, and so it's visually appealing, but as far as the competition goes, coxswains will be challenged as well.
Local supporters hope the national championship will also give a much-needed boost to Cleveland's economy. Brad Whitehead is president of the Fund for Our Economic Future, a collaboration of local nonprofits working to improve the city's growth. He says there's already been new retail investment in the mostly industrial neighborhood around Rivergate Park, and with the coming development of a nearby bike path and riverfront casino, he says there'll be more.
The river has been a bit of the Rodney Dangerfield of our community. It's this wonderful resource that we have that many cities around the globe would lust after. And I think we're starting to rediscover it and seeing that it can be a heart of recreation in the community and a place where things are going on.
After next year's debut, the U.S. Rowing Masters Head Race National Championship will travel to 3 other cities, then return to Cleveland in 2016. By then, people here hope that Cleveland's new credentials in national rowing competition will have finally moved beyond that old image of the burning river. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Schaefer in Cleveland.
The Lord can make you turn. The Lord can make you overflow. But the Lord can make you burn. Burn on, big river, burn on. Burn on, big river, burn on.
You're listening to Only a Game.
Mm-hmm.
couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to speak with celebrated historian and author Taylor Branch about his Atlantic Monthly article examining the hypocrisy of big-time college sports, past and present. Afterward, Mr. Branch tweeted as follows, "It was fun to be on your show. Nobody yelled at me, although that can be fun, too." When the Red Sox fell short of the playoffs last week, some Boston fans were probably moved to tears. Several of our listeners were moved to verse. Erica Fine, who hears the program on WBUR, borrowed her meter from The Night Before Christmas, which perhaps accounts for the appearance of words and phrases such as "twas," "snug," and "arose such a clatter" in a baseball poem. Ed Sevilla was also moved to rhyme. He wrote to the rhythm of "Casey at the Bat." In his version, the guy who couldn't come through wasn't a hitter. It was Boston relief pitcher Jonathan Papelbon. The poem concludes as follows, "Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright, the band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light, and somewhere sports talk shows pour forth wit, charm, sweet reason, but there's no joy in the nation. Mighty Pap has blown the season." A separate team had such creative fans. Maybe it's self-defense. We also heard this week from Royal Webster, a Tigers fan who lives in Baldwin, Missouri. He suggests that the Red Sox and Braves should play each other in what he thinks should be called the Chokemanship Series. I wrote back and said the event would probably be rained out. Jim Hershey, who hears only a game on KWMU in St. Louis, was disappointed with at least one aspect of last week's show, which occurred while the Rugby World Cup was in progress. Imagine my disappointment when the only time rugby was mentioned was in a quote by a spectator in a story about another sport, he wrote. That other sport was cricket, the mention of which Mike Rosenberg enjoyed. He wrote to further inform me that although the gentlemen playing cricket in 1870 in Needham, Massachusetts, tried to teach the game to their children and grandchildren, those rascals and scamps would have none of it, which is why cricket disappeared from cricket field until 2 weeks ago. You can chirp at us via the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
If it is passed, a proposal submitted this week to the State Board of Education in Hawaii would recognize surfing as a legitimate high school sport. This would no doubt encourage thousands and thousands of teenagers from Hukipa to Lanikia and Honolulu to Velzeland to take up the sport, since now they'll be able to earn high school letters by surfing. Alex Da Silva, a spokesperson for the proposal, says there has been, quote, a groundswell of support for the formalization of surfing. Several surfers who swore they'd totally have been in class if the surf hadn't been up this week said they thought that groundswell was swell and asked if they'd still have to take phys ed. Surfer's holiday. Come on, surfer's holiday. Yeah, grab your boards and follow us to surfer's holiday. Come on, surfer's holiday. Yeah, grab your boards and follow us to surfer's holiday. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the ultimate demonstration that it's the journey that counts and not the destination. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Suppose you end up in, like, Columbus, Ohio.
Keep listening and you'll learn what I'm talking about. Anyway, as the NBA lockout has dragged on, Commissioner David Stern has been slicing away at the product his league provides. We'll have no training camps this fall and no preseason games. When does the cutting stop?
The cutting stops when there is some sort of resolution, and I know that sounds obvious, but right now they seem further away from that than anything. There seems to be some general feeling that Derek Fisher and Billy Hunter should take the latest miserable proposal from management to their membership for a vote so we can get a season. unfortunately, our getting a season isn't the primary objective here. Maintaining a fairly equitable labor management balance is.
The tickets for today's South Florida All-Star Classic, which will feature LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and various other NBA standouts, sold very quickly. I wonder, should we interpret that as a show of support for the players?
I think it's a show of support for people wanting basketball. It's a good thing. I'm glad they're out there doing this. It's a very good piece of public relations.
Meanwhile, Pau and Marc Gasol will practice with Barcelona. Kobe Bryant reportedly has been offered $1 million one-game deal in Italy. And Tony Parker has made plans to play for a team in France that will pay him a little less than $2,000 a month. If the NBA season does start, will he have enough money to fly back to San Antonio?
Well, he is part owner of the team, so he's probably raking it in. One pocket is probably taking it in while one pocket necessarily goes a little dry. It does give you an indication of the success of David Stern in spreading the game worldwide. His currently locked out players have many places to go to play now.
A simmering feud between Kentucky coach John Calipari and Louisville coach Rick Pitino has led one analyst to suggest this week that those two coaches hate each other more than any other rivals in college basketball. I suppose that's a distinction of sorts. Is it accurate?
Oh, it probably certainly is. You're talking about two king egos in the same state running amok. And you're talking about John Calipari, who's the poster child for just about everything that's wrong with college sports. So there we are.
The mighty New York Yankees have been eliminated from the playoffs. The Detroit Tigers will play in their first AL Championship Series since 2006. That's tonight in Texas. Having beaten New York, will Detroit have anything left?
Oh, I think so. I think they handled New York fairly easily, and as long as they've got Justin Verlander left, they're in good shape in any playoff series.
The Florida Marlins did not qualify for baseball's postseason, Charlie. If they had, perhaps the Marlins reliever, who has been known as Leo Nunez, wouldn't have chosen October as the time to reveal that he's not really Leo Nunez at all. Who is he?
He's Juan Carlos Oviedo, who apparently adopted the identity of a friend of his because at the level of baseball that he was playing at when he was in his teens, 16-year-olds were apparently more valuable than 17-year-olds, so he took the name of a younger friend named Leo Nunez and has subsequently made it all the way to the Marlins with it.
And had a $6 million, $7 million contract offered to him, which I gather may be somewhat in jeopardy.
Well, I'm not lawyer enough. I don't even play lawyer enough on Only a Game to know whether those contracts are valid or not.
I saw a headline this week that read, "Good news for Mets fans," and there are limits to my imagination, so help me out with that.
They're cutting ticket prices for their miserable Bernie Madoff-tainted product up to 39%. They finished fourth. They missed the playoffs for 5 years in a row. Nobody's coming to their ballpark. Attendance is down 22.5%. They're trying to make it cheaper so people show up.
Monday Night Football did not sound the same on Monday night. And
how would you know?
I'm told that it didn't sound the same on Monday night, and I'm told that it will never sound the same again. What happened to end the partnership between ESPN and Hank Williams Jr., whose rhetorical, "Are you ready for some football?" has so long been part of the production?
Apparently, they're ready for football at ESPN, but not ready for Hank Williams to compare the president to Hitler. Hmm. Hank Williams said something untoward about the president and made the Hitler comparison, which is never popular and never a good idea in any context ever, and he's been asked to leave the premises by ESPN, never to return.
The NFL is always looking for ways to make the Super Bowl even more super, and at the next edition of the Game of Games, fans will be allowed to participate in Media Day. Talk about something that may be a curse rather than a blessing. Anyway, do you suppose they'll ask questions more intelligent than the ones asked by various media people?
you mean asked by the lady from MTV or the guy dressed as a banana?
I've seen
both, by the way, at Media Day. Media Days is a horrible experience for everyone involved. This is a horrible idea about a horrible experience. I don't know who thought this was a good idea, but they're guaranteed for at least one or two fistfights in Indianapolis.
Two former college football players, Derek Owens and Alex Rux, have sued the NCAA for failing to protect them from injuries that have resulted, quote, in preventable brain trauma. The lawsuit seeks to force the NCAA to institute a medical monitoring program. How is it that there was no medical monitoring program?
Because the NCAA is like a stubborn mule. They don't do anything until you hit them over the head with a 2x4.
Or a lawsuit.
Taylor Branch pointed out in his now famous article in Atlantic Monthly that the phrase student athlete was invented basically to get so the NCAA could dodge workman's comp suits. This you're seeing is the final result of that. These are people who are suing the NCAA to force the NCAA to do something it should have done automatically when this issue first arose.
Wayne Rooney stars for Manchester United and makes a lot of money at his trade. Do you think that maybe this week he wishes he'd funneled some of that wealth to his father?
Yeah, his father got busted in a betting scandal along with Wayne Rooney's Uncle Richie, who's identified in the Sun story as Uncle Richie, and who I guess probably has a mob name called Uncle Richie.
But
in any event, there are a couple of nine people being quizzed over this betting scandal. The arrest took place in Liverpool and Glasgow, and it had something to do with a game between Scottish teams Motherwell and Hearts. And doesn't that sound like they should be playing on Hallmark Memorial Stadium? I play for Motherwell. I play for Hearts.
Don't let any Scots hear you say that. Golfer Elliot Saltman is ranked 686th in the world, Charlie, well behind the leaders at the Madrid Masters as we speak. So why is he celebrating?
All I can think of is the scene in Best in Show where the Weimaraner goes after the judge and Fred Willard says, oh, he went after her like she was made out of ham. Elliot Saltman made a hole-in-one during the Madrid Masters and won the prize, which was his body weight in ham.
And finally, Charlie, presumably because he wants to hear you shout sports.
Sports!
A listener named Dan Jacobson emailed this week to insist that I tell you that next week in the Netherlands, the World Contract Bridge Championships will transpire. So would you care to once again oblige Mr. Jacobson?
Sports! Apparently, Iceland is the favorite to win the World Contract Bridge
Championship. Long winter there.
Which they're competing in the Netherlands for something called the Bermuda Bowl.
Yeah.
Sports is very confusing.
Charlie Pierce is the politics blog at Esquire magazine, and he takes some time to visit the toy department each week with me as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In her new book, The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, Melissa Holbrook Pearson describes John Ryan as, quote, a metaphor about human transcendence made real and clothed in one hell of a suit. The explanation for the suit, which is somewhat space age, John Ryan is a long-distance motorcycle rider, long distance, as in, oh, say, 1,000 miles a day for a couple of weeks. No stops except for gas, very fast food, and minimal hygiene. Melissa Holbrook Pearson joins me now from the State University of New York at New Paltz. Melissa, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks.
You begin The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing by introducing us to John Ryan, whose achievements as a long-distance motorcyclist seem superhuman, beyond the fact that he's done things like ride 5,645 miles in 86 and a half hours. What sets Mr. Ryan apart from everybody else who rides long distances on a motorcycle?
Well, like so many adventurers in our history, like Sir Edmund Hillary, he's a person who can't say no to a challenge. He doesn't want to say no. In fact, I think it's what defines him. I think he sets himself apart by sort of mischievously thumbing his nose at the rest of us who need things like sleep and, you know, we want to eat actual hot meals, you know, things like that.
He has no interest in these things.
Absolutely no interest. This is a man who, when he needs to, will tear open a packet of salmon with his teeth and eat it with his fingers.
Presumably while he's still moving.
He, in fact, does keep food in his tank bag, and he's got a straw so that he can hydrate while riding. He's got an enormous gas tank. It's ridiculous. People look at his motorcycle, and for a minute, you see it pass before their eyes. They can't quite grasp what they're seeing.
And the nutritional component of this is complicated by the fact that he's diabetic.
Indeed. I think that might be behind some of his drive. He may be outrunning the mortality that most of us see coming when you achieve middle age, as he has. So it's both something that propels him and something that could potentially cause him harm.
Melissa, I should mention that you're not writing about long-distance motorcycling from a long distance. You've ridden saddle sores and bun burners yourself, and before we go any further, perhaps you should explain what those terms mean.
Right. A saddle sore is 1,000 miles in 24 hours or less.
Mm-hmm.
A bun burner is 1,500 miles in 36 hours or less. A bun burner gold, which John Ryan has done three back-to-back, is 1,500 miles in under 24 hours.
And you did not take on saddle sores and bun burners just because you wanted to write about what it was like and about the people who did it a lot. Tell us a little bit about the history of your own passion for motorcycles.
I was a rider in the early 80s. And I was just a plain, normal, vanilla rider. But I stopped riding, like a lot of people do, when other things got in the way, such as family, work, you know, that whole growing up business. And I took a hiatus, and I thought that I had put motorcycles behind me. Well, you know, you really can't do that when they're in your blood. They'll come and find you. And 11 years later, something happened in my life that caused a bit of a stoppage. And for a moment there, I didn't know which way to turn. Enter John Ryan. This guy is so persistent, not only in his riding, but in his personality. And he believes that everybody should be on a motorcycle. It's the only way to go. In fact, this is a man who doesn't own a car. He doesn't have a house, a wife, a job. Anyway, he kept after me. He said, you need to be on a motorcycle. And finally, when I ran out of excuses, I said, yeah, I do. He's right. And I'm never going to look back.
You write about several rallies set up for long-distance motorcyclists who were directed to visit, albeit very briefly, various places. One of those rallies features the locations of America's most notorious crimes. Would you read the paragraph, please, on page 56 that sets the scene for that rally?
Monday morning dawns sunny and warm, ideal for the beginning of an epic both useless and so deeply meaningful it cracks the brain to fathom it, both bold and foolhardy. When these 100 riders, now milling around their motorcycles with anticipation's knuckles white around their guts, leave the parking lot of the Marriott, they will be going to more places than crime scenes spread across the United States of America, which may well be the crime capital of the world. They will be going to elemental places within themselves, elemental places on our anthropological timeline, too, it turns out.
Tell me about elemental places, both internal and external.
This rally, which comprises 11 days and approximately 11,000 miles, tests people in a way that normal life doesn't. There's, I think, a certain pleasure in the human being in meeting extreme challenges, and that's what these people do. Most of them feel that it changes their lives forever.
You talk about extreme challenges, and the book includes mention of lots of records set by long-distance motorcyclists. Which of those records seem most impressive to you?
Well, the ones where people just decide to take off from one coast, ride straight to the other coast, and then back again, basically without stopping. These are purposeless trips, except for maybe a paramount purpose which exists inside. The ride that John Ryan took that you spoke of at the beginning here, to me, is one of the most extraordinary things anybody's ever done.
Please describe that ride for me.
He rode from above the Arctic Circle, Prudhoe Bay, which was icy, wet, rainy. It took him a week just to get to the starting point because his bike would slide down the mountain and, you know, otherwise injure itself. And once he started, he didn't stop for 86 and a half hours, except for approximately 2 hours each day until he reached the farthest south point in the United States, Key West, Florida. He was determined to bury the record of the previous record holder, and he did so by over 9 hours.
At some point, it occurred to you that, and I'm quoting now, souls are the province of motorcycles alone among machines. How and when did you come to that conclusion?
I think anybody who spends enough time on the road with their motorcycle will feel that way, because you realize that there were chances for it to do things to you, both good and bad. And you communicate and you rely on it to a huge degree. You're not placing your life in the hands of your computer, but you are your motorcycle.
Melissa Holbrook-Pearson is the author of The Man Who Would Stop at Nothing, Long Distance Motorcycling's Endless Road. The book is published by Norton, and the author joined me from the State University of New York at New Paltz. Melissa, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thank you.
We'll get matching jackets and helmets too. We'll get respect from the towns we ride through. We'll sleep at the roadside in the soft green grass. And if the squares won't buy, we'll let them pass. You'll be the queen of my highway, my motorcycle mama. We'll see the world from my Harley.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Jillian Geib. We had help this week from Joe D'Agostino at SUNY New Paltz, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Schaefer's rowing photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at onlyagameradio. Our final word comes from Melissa Holbrook-Pearson, who reacts thusly when I tell her that I had given up motorcycling decades ago.
But maybe we can get you back someday.
Yeah, well, if that 1969 BSA Starfire 250 turns up, maybe. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Got something better to do. Stick around the house the rest of your life. You're 18, you can be my wife. You be the queen of my highway, my motorcycle mama. And we'll see the world from my Harley. And we'll see the world from my Harley. And we'll see the world from my Harley. If the chain don't break.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change, at ajws.org. This is NPR.